Blog Talk Radio.
This is XPN, the Floppy's Broadcast Network. My name is Jill Brenneman. Our musical introduction is by Jim Donovan from, well, formerly of Rusted Root. Thank you, Jim, for allowing us to use your outstanding music. We also would like to credit some new musical artists who have agreed to join us. After Slash Model has added music, given us permission to use their music. Also, Michelle Malone. Our sincere appreciation to both of them. Today, my guest, Audacia Ray. She edits the Village Voice Sexuality blog, NakedCity.com, and produces the weekly video show Naked City TV. She is the author of Naked City on the Internet, Hookups, Downloads, and Calling In on the Internet, Sexploration, and is the award-winning director and producer of the porn feature by Apple. Audacia, you gave me more of a bio, and my computer crashed, and I can't see what the rest of it is. So if you could share it, well.
The rest of it was that I'm also a former sex worker, and I was executive editor of Spread for 3 years. And at the moment, I'm working on a new nonprofit called Sex Work Awareness. And one of the new projects is a public education project for sex work awareness. It's called Sex Work 101. It's a blog that is meant to do basic public education around issues that face sex workers.
Wow, that's an outstanding project. Well, first of all, welcome to XPN. Can you tell the audience some about your project?
Which one? let's talk a little bit about sex work awareness. Basically, I was an editor at Spread Magazine for 3 years. I'm not a founding editor, but I started working on the magazine right before the first issue debuted. And after 3 years, I got kind of burnt out on it because it's an all-volunteer project, and meeting deadlines on a volunteer basis is sometimes kind of challenging. So I've sort of passed the torch on Spread, though I'm still very involved because in many ways that project is really my baby. So I can't entirely kiss it goodbye. But one of the things that we started seeing at Spread was this need for public education and media workshops and outreach to sex workers and education for sex workers on not just how to deal with the media, but also how to produce their own media. And Spread, we decided, had sort of limited scope in our ability to be involved as an advocacy organization because, the work of producing 4 issues of a glossy magazine every year is a lot of work, and to add advocacy on top of that is pretty challenging. So we decided to form a nonprofit organization that's called Sex Work Awareness. And Sex Work Awareness was actually incorporated in 2006, and we've just finally gotten the paperwork together to apply for 501c3 status. So we're waiting for that to go through. But the mission is basically to help create awareness of issues that face sex workers and also to help arm sex workers with the tools to deal with mainstream media and also empower them to create their own media.
You know, that's such an important topic, you know, both of which, both in how to deal with the media, you know, the mainstream media, because there's such an, unless you deal with them on a consistent basis, and realize that essentially they know nothing usually about the issue, and they have an agenda usually, or they just need sound bites for whatever's going to boost their Nielsen's or Arbitrons. It can be a pretty intimidating experience. And, you know, in terms of creating your own media, it's such a vital resource, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, for me, you know, for myself, like the ability to create my own media has empowered me to say no a lot more to mainstream media because, and I wrote a post on Sex Work 101 this past weekend about this, called Why Should Sex Workers Talk to the Media? And, you know, I mean, the initial impulse is, of course, we want to get our stories out there. We want to be heard. It's important to have a sex worker's perspective in conversations that are happening about us because it's extremely irritating to see lots of press about the sex industry that never ever consults people who work in the industry. But on the other hand, if you work in the industry, the mainstream media doesn't have a lot of awareness about what our issues are and the risk of exposure we have by talking to them, and sometimes they're less than careful with our personal information. I mean, just this past weekend, a friend of mine here in New York who blogs as Debauchee, who is an independent escort, during the Spitzer Madness last month, she agreed to talk to Diane Sawyer on just a really kind of horrendous expose on the sex industry, and she was sort of posited as the one woman on the show who chose to be a sex worker, and they concealed her identity and, you know, put her in shadow and disguised her voice and stuff. But her parents happened to see the show and recognized her, and, you know, kind of sat on it a while. But then they, you know, they emailed her and were like, "We saw you on TV. We know what you do now." And so, you know, even when steps are taken to conceal identities, there's, you know, there's some stuff they said, you know, even though your voice was disguised, the way you touch your hair, the way you say certain words, or, you know, certain phrases you use were dead giveaway. So that's a really intense thing, and you know, when that kind of fallout happens, obviously the mainstream media is not going to be helpful, and they're not going to do follow-up and help people out after they've been exposed because they just don't care.
Wow, that's, you know, it's even more knowledge, you know, the interview itself that Diane Sawyer did, you know, I felt, you know, with your friend, I mean, I thought she was terrible with your friend, you know, that she was dismissive and condescending and scorning, and on top of it, you know, she outed her to her parents and you know, made it a completely destructive situation, really.
Yeah, no, of course. And you know, and that, I mean, similar things happened, and this was on Bound Not Gagged a couple of weeks ago. The New York Times piece about call girls and their double lives. Two of the women who were interviewed extensively for that piece had identifying information revealed that you know, people who were their clients read the piece and were able to very easily identify them and were kind of outraged that they were, you know, putting their clients at risk, whether or not that's really the case or whether or not that's something that we should all be concerned about is another issue entirely. But it was something that, you know, actually really threatened their livelihood, and that's something that's really scary and, you know, obviously makes a lot of sex workers think twice, or should make sex workers think twice about talking to the media.
You know, and the really sad thing is that by and large, as sex workers and sex worker rights advocates, we're going to the media to do constructive social justice and getting shredded for it and getting exploited for it and being misrepresented and scorned. And so the importance of creating alternative media, you know, where we can get a call from ABC saying Diane Sawyer wants to interview you, and we can say, well, I'll tell you what, have her call me and I'll interview her.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And just, you know, whether or not you're saying no to mainstream media, and making your own media, I mean, it's also important to use self-produced media as a way to counter what gets said about you in the mainstream media. And, you know, I mean, I use my personal blog as a tool to speak out against mainstream media during the Spitzer scandal, because one of the first nights of that, I got a call from a booker from MSNBC who, one of the first questions he asked me was, had I been a whore? And he used that word, and then he immediately backtracked and was apologetic and said he didn't think that was the right terminology. But after I got off the phone with him and, you know, turned down the media request, I kind of seethed over it for a little bit, and then I was like, you know what, I'm going to blog about this, and I'm going to name the network and name the show. And it really made a difference. I mean, it made a big splash. And, you know, in previous years, for some reason, though I can't entirely explain it now, I had previously blogged about mainstream media's treatment of me, but I didn't name the network. And now I realize the power of naming the network and the show, because they don't want their image to be tarnished. And it really creates a big splash and makes people really kind of sit up and pay attention. And then as the week progressed, the next day I also wrote about other kind of media requests I had been getting, and again named the networks and what they had been asking for. And then by the third day of the scandal, when I was getting calls, people were saying, I've read your blog and I understand your concerns, which is really pretty awesome. And I was excited that that seemed to seep in so quickly. And of course, I mean, you know, we'll have to do the same exact process the next time there's some big scandal that people want to talk to hookers about. But, you know, I found that as a really important tool. It was like, you know what, I am going to speak back against them, and there is power in doing this and writing this down and talking about it freely. And, you know, mainstream media seems not very interested in having transparency, but the internet and blog culture is all about transparency, so I'm just going to keep doing that.
You know, it reminds me of my own first experience with both the media and with activism in general. My first speech, my very first speech, I wasn't told the media was going to be there. I didn't even really want to do the speech. You know, it was a last-minute third choice, and pretty much did it because I knew they were in a bind, and was not told that the mainstream media was going to be there, and people were taking pictures, and at that point it was, you know, my first gig, and I didn't really know how to say no pictures, and, you know, I was kind of overwhelmed just by the thought that I was doing a speaking presentation. And the next day I am on the front page of the major newspaper in Minneapolis, and there's my picture, and it describes me as a recovering heroin addict, and I have never even touched heroin. And, you know, I had a quote-unquote straight job, you know, and guess what happened when I got to work? You know, I get called in the office, and it's pretty hard to say, you know, it was a mistake, you know, when there it is, and
yeah, and who are they going to believe?
With my picture, yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, and things like that are really good arguments for not talking to the media. And I know, like, obviously I say that as someone who freely talks to the media, and sometimes people say things to me like, oh, you know, you're so brave for doing this. And maybe I'm brave now, but I think initially when I started talking to the media, I was stupid, not brave. You know, I didn't know what the reach of that stuff could be, and, you know, what the potential for it was in both good and bad ways. And, you know, I was definitely naive when I first started talking to the media, and, you know, so a lot of it was definitely not bravery, and it was not well thought out, and it was not planned, and I didn't think of what the repercussions could be. And, you know, luckily, like, this kind of work is my chosen path in life. But there's still, you know, still a lot of awkward moments and, you know, points of intensity with my family, or, you know, straight jobs I've had and stuff like that. So it's not consequence free, even for people like me who are wholly devoted to doing this work and, you know, being front and center and not ashamed and everything, there's still a lot of touchy moments.
What would be advice that you would give, you know, both to, well, let's start off with, you know, dealing with the mainstream media. What type of advice do you give from your nonprofit?
Well, I mean, like I mentioned before, I'd actually written a blog post about this. It's on sexwork101.com that I wrote this weekend. And first of all, the main thing that I think sex workers should think of if they get a request for media, because sometimes requests for media will actually come if you advertise online or in newspapers, sometimes you'll get media who actually calls your work line, which can be a little unsettling if you're picking up the phone and expecting to talk to a client, and it's CNN on the line. That can be really disconcerting. So the first thing you should consider is, what do I get out of doing this? And that can be like a that's the really, really basic thing. And, you know, that could be like the pleasure of getting heard by a broader audience, which for many people is very satisfying. That could be exposure that you think might help you get more work, like a book deal. You know, that's definitely happened to people who have spoken out in public. You know, will they be paying you? That's highly unlikely. And then, you know, what do you stand to lose from this? Like, who could see it? And despite steps taken to conceal identity, whether your working identity or your legal name or whatever, what if those things fail? Or, you know, what if people recognize you? What will that do? What could you lose? So it's really important to kind of consider both sides of that. And then ask lots of questions. You know, how will they protect your identity and your livelihood if you're a currently working sex worker and you work in the legal part of the industry? I would give a real hard think about whether or not you want to talk to the media. I personally usually advise people not to, because if it's something that could really seriously threaten your livelihood or put you under risk of being under surveillance or getting arrested, then it's just not worth it. And then, you know, then of course details about like where will this interview be and, you know, who's doing it. And, you know, deep down in your gut, like, do you believe that this interview will respect you and will they represent you carefully or fairly? And if in your gut you have a bad feeling about the person who you're talking to or is interviewing you, then just don't do it. And, sometimes it is sort of hard to say no, and people who are bookers of first shows or journalists in general are masters at making you feel like you're talking to a trusted friend. That's their job. They're trying to pull a story out of you. So if you haven't had a lot of practice doing this kind of thing, you might find yourself, you know, on air or sitting in a coffee shop with a reporter and, like, having a casual conversation with them that you then later realize is on record and is going to be showing up in print somewhere or televised or on the radio. So if you don't trust yourself to be able to curtail the way you speak and to shut up when you think you should shut up, then doing media appearances might not be for you. And that's something that definitely takes time to master. And I've for sure made stupid mistakes along the way and said the wrong thing that's then, you know, been put in quotes or been, like, horrendously misquoted. Like, one time I was quoted in a magazine as having said, sex work should be fun. And I definitely never said that. And, you know, sometimes that's a big deal and sometimes you can laugh it off. It depends how much press you're doing or how sensitive you are to it. So that's sort of the long rundown of things you should consider. But basically, you know, it's what do you get out of it? What could you stand to lose are the two biggest questions that you need to answer honestly for yourself. And those are things that you should sit by yourself and answer. Because I know that there have been times for me when I've been talking to someone from the mainstream media in a context where I know there is no other sex worker who's willing to talk to this person, and that if I don't talk to this person, I don't do this interview, our perspective will not be represented. And sometimes it's a really difficult thing to turn away and say no to that. But sometimes it's a really necessary thing too, because if they're going to just, you know, run your story into the ground and do things with your words that are bad for you personally, even if it does somehow serve the greater movement, it's probably not worth doing. Because when it comes down to it, you have to pay your rent, you have to be able to deal with your family, and sacrificing that for the movement, I just think is not worth it.
You know, some of it's almost astonishing, you know, having seen it myself, you know, some of the quotes you almost, you're pissed off at, but you, they're almost so absurd that you're somewhere between angry and laughing because you're so horrifically misquoted that, you know, I know from personal experience, having done my one and only daytime talk show, you know, when I balked at doing what they wanted, they literally just re-edited what I said. And the words coming out of my mouth on the picture on the show, and this was like a Fox network show, so it wasn't, you know, like Joe's TV channel, and I couldn't believe it. It's like the words coming out of my mouth didn't even match my lips.
Yeah,
you know, they didn't even take the effort to.
And the thing is, sometimes some media can be held accountable for that, and some cannot. Like, most talk shows will make you sign a very long release, and they'll kind of sneak it in on you right before you go on the air. And if you have questions about it, they don't know who you should talk to about it. And that contract is pretty ferocious usually, and basically says that they can do whatever the fuck they want with your words and your image. I mean, most media that you talk to, like doing shows like that where you do a studio appearance for a talk show, usually have you sign long, crazy contracts. But if you just talk to someone for like an AP article or even, you know, nightly news, they never will have you sign a contract. So you do have some leverage there to approach them. But, you know, on a talk show, basically, if you bitch at them, they're going to be like, you signed away your rights. And that's true. You did sign away your rights. So not only do you
sign away your rights, but that what caught my attention was the liquidated damages clause, that, you know, if you absolutely won't go on the show now, or you try to get an injunction, you're on the hook for $10,000 liquidated damages. And you're right, and it got sprung on me. I wish I'd had access to your website, because all of the things that you're discussing are all mistakes that, you know, like you said, I learned the hard way myself. And it's astonishing. What are things that you suggest in terms of creating new media? You know, media for ourselves, how to do it, why to do it.
Well, I think, again, you know, what any kind of media that you're making, the first consideration is the degree of exposure and outness that you're willing to engage in. And I think that should be a really big concern for anyone doing this kind of work. So before you, you know, start a radio show or write a blog or start pitching articles to magazines, you need to think about what kind of exposure are you comfortable with. You know, for instance, if you write for a magazine, you're probably going to have to sign some sort of contract and give them some of your financial information so they can send you tax documents and stuff like that, which means that you have to give them your legal name. And, you know, the vast majority of publications will obviously respect if you want to write under a pen name, but some of them are not into that. I mean, like, if you have an established pen name, one that is, you know, essentially your working name that you're publicly identifiable with, that's usually okay. But for some of the bigger magazines and newspapers, like the Washington Post, for example, I've had dealings with, they do not let people write under pseudonyms. Established pen names are acceptable, like I said, if there's, you know, public currency basically that exists around that name. But if you are a working girl and you want to tell a personal story, but you don't want to use your working name or your legal name, that's not going to fly for a paper like the Washington Post at all. So then you have to think, okay, how worth it is this? Even if the pay is really good, should I associate my legal name with this? So that's a really, really big concern. And that's dealing with mainstream media. But in dealing with your own self-produced media, there's still going to be that level of associating some sort of identity with what you're doing. So that's a pretty important thing. And I think is the reason why a lot of people don't identify as activists and don't participate in making media, because of the fear of exposure, which is a very, very real fear. You hear of people all the time who are, you know, not creating media but are advertising services online, who get stalkers, who, you know, track their IP address and their location and stuff like that, all which is fairly simple to do these days. So, before you participate in any liberal media, you have to decide what your comfort level of exposure is, A, and B, what you will do if things go a little bit out of control and beyond your comfort level. One of the things that I think is really helpful, like I'm doing this with Sex Work 101, and I know that Bound Not Gagged does this also, is that you can submit stories by email and then have other people publish your stuff. So you don't have to create your own blog account and stuff like that and have those things tied to your IP address or any sort of internet identity. So that can be a really good way to go. That's also a really kind of good way to flirt with media involvement, instead of making the commitment of saying, like, okay, I'm going to figure out how to podcast, or I'm going to figure out how to blog, or, you know, that kind of stuff, and making that level of technical and time commitment. You can kind of flirt with it by saying, okay, like, maybe I should write to this podcast or, you know, blog radio or whatever, and say I'd like to participate in one episode, or write to a blog and say, hey, can I write a guest post on whatever? So that can be sort of a good and fairly safe way to test the waters. But I think in general, producing online media is really where it's at, mostly because even if your website, your project doesn't get tons of traffic initially, when you write on a blog, that stuff gets indexed by Google, which means, A, it exists on the internet forever, which is really important to remember as you're thinking about what you're going to write about and how you're going to identify yourself. But that also, the good part of that is that it will be findable by search engines. So even if your website only gets a little bit of traffic, if you use phrases that are commonly searched for, then it is possible that people will find your website and find your story.
I'm Joe Brenneman. This is XBN, the Swathist Broadcast Network. My guest is Audacia Ray. We would love it if you join in the conversation. You can do so by calling area code 646-200-3136. Once again, 646-200-3136, you can call in. So far, our only other participant has, which I don't know if you could hear it or not, has been my dog in the background. She's been more than vocal to share with us that there are squirrels on the patio and geese outside. But if anyone would like to call in with topics other than squirrels and geese, you're certainly all welcome to. You can also go to xxbn.live and click the chat cube and sending questions or comments that way. How about your new job at the Naked City for the Village Voice?
Naked City is a new sexuality blog for the Village Voice, on which I'm doing, like, at the moment it's 25 posts a week, which involves sort of a broad range of topics. And what I'm trying to do with it is to do a range of things from, you know, short, fun stuff. Like, I have a woman who's writing sort of a daily sex diary that's five short moments of her day, as well as, you know, pictures and quick links to fun websites. And also, I do in-depth interviews with people twice a week. And I've also been doing a weekly video show. It's called Naked City TV. And I covered this guy named Porno Jim, who does a show called The Porno Jim Show. That's sort of a how to find good porn, which is a theater show. So I did a piece on him, and I did a video piece on the Sex 2.0 gathering in Atlanta that happened a week and a half ago. And just yesterday I put up an episode that was a tour of the new home of the Center for Sex and Culture in San Francisco. So I've been doing a wide range of video type interviews and coverage. And I've also been sort of integrating my personal agenda into the blog by doing a good amount of stuff that's focusing on the sex industry. For example, I have on Tuesdays, so this will go up later tonight, a weekly column from the blogger Renegade Evolution that's called Sex Worker Rant. And basically I'm just kind of giving her the floor to talk about annoying things that sex workers have to deal with and face up to. So there's that. And on Thursdays, I run a column that's called Porn at Large, in which I have four porn producers, directors, and performers from all over the world writing about what it's like to make porn, where they're from. So I have someone from Canada, someone from Spain, someone from Germany, and someone from Australia writing that column. So although, you know, the Village Voice obviously is based here in New York, I'm trying to go a little beyond New York, although, of course, New York is my first love. So it's been a really cool project so far, and the Village Voice has been really supportive and pretty hands-off, which is totally to my liking. And they've pretty much let me do whatever I want, and I've sort of tested the limits of decency with a couple of different things. Like, we never had a real conversation about how explicit the stuff I could show on the blog would be, so I just decided to post some really explicit stuff and see if they said anything, and so far so good. So I kind of have the freedom to do all sorts of different stuff, and you know, ranging from very lighthearted, like last night I put up a post called 8 Niche Dating Sites That You Don't Know About Yet, to, you know, a lot more heavy and serious stuff. Like, I'm doing a 4-part series on the sex industry and religion I'm putting up on Mondays throughout April.
Colleen in Sacramento has written and asked if you could give the web addresses once again as she of your various sites, as she has missed. She has missed the URLs of how to find you.
Sure thing. Well, my personal blog and projects are at wakingvixen.com. That's my blog that's now almost 4 years old, that originally started as a place for me to explore my own personal journeys through sex and the sex industry, but it's sort of evolved into a record of what it is that I'm doing all the time. So that's my personal site. My Village Voice blog is at nakedcity.com, and the public education project of sex work awareness is sexwork101.com. What else there is? I also have a video blog that I do twice a week that's called livegirlreview.com. It's all reviews of sexuality, media, and products. I tend to do a lot of book reviews, but I also sometimes do sex toys and porn and stuff like that there.
What do you find the responses? Do you find that the response is mostly positive? You know, when you brought up Renegade Evolution, you know, Renegade Evolution is a she. I think she's really funny and hysterical. She's one of those. She is, you know, a verbal ninja.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, actually. I mean, I met Ren in person for the first time at Sex 2.0 on April 12th. And it was interesting because she and I had this conversation about this because, yeah, I mean, she is a verbal ninja and she does get a lot of intense reactions to her work. And, you know, her blog posts have like 30 to 50 comments and stuff like that. And blog posts I write generally just don't get that many comments. And I think a lot of it's our differing approaches. And, you know, not to say that either one is right or wrong. I mean, I'm a great admirer of her work, and I also think she's hilarious, although obviously not all people do. But I think we just have very different approaches. I mean, what people tend to say about me, like after they've seen me speak or argue with people, is that my approach tends to be sort of low-key, and I try to be as logical as possible and also extremely friendly. So I tend to get mostly positive reactions. Like, I don't have any major blog hecklers like Ren does at all. Like, I've never really had that problem. And I get some hate mail, but not a whole lot. Mostly I get really supportive emails and messages and stuff like that. So I have been lucky that I haven't had a huge problem with the haters. But I think that's sort of an approach thing. Like I don't write as though I'm going to battle, and I think that Ren does that. Again, not that either is right or wrong. I mean, she, I think, often stirs up a lot more conversation than I do, though maybe it's not always productive conversation. But yeah, I think it's just different approaches, and I like to see that sort of scope of different people's personalities and abilities and stuff like that.
This is XBM. My name is Jill Brenneman. My guest is Audacia Ray. You can join us 646-200-3136. You know, it's funny because I met Ren in person last night myself for the first time at the debate with William and Mary. And yeah, I was kind of thinking about the haters and you know, all this discussion about you know, how afraid they were of her and how, you know, and it was amazing when I met her. I mean, here's this very petite woman.
Yeah.
You know, she's all of 110 pounds, you know, and it just totally, to be perfectly honest, I didn't even recognize her at first. She came up to me and started talking to me, and I was like, I don't know who this is.
Who's this energetic little woman?
Who's this energetic little woman? You know, I was trying to think. You know, I just done a presentation at William & Mary a month ago, and I'm not really a face person. And I was trying to think to myself, did I meet her last time? I just don't remember her.
Mm-hmm.
And then it struck me, it was Ren. And I'm like, wow. You know. And
I mean, I think, you know, also the reactions to her are interesting because I think people are obviously afraid of angry women. And you know, the idea of her being scary is sort of a projection of how people feel about sex workers in general. It's just that she's sort of like steps up to bat with that. And I think, you know, like sometimes I do a lot of talks at colleges around the New York area that are very like sex work 101, that I usually start out talking about the legal and labor issues and, you know, sexuality, feminist issues around the sex industry. And then about 2/3 of the way through my talk, I admit that I myself have been a sex worker, and then everything changes, and that's, of course, all anyone wants to talk about. But usually, you know, what people say to me afterwards is, you know, wow, like, this really changed my idea of what sex workers are. Like, I've never met a sex worker before, which is probably totally untrue. They just don't know that they've met sex workers. And they seem to have this sense of relief at having a face-to-face conversation with someone who works in the sex industry, because I think a lot of people are genuinely afraid of people who work in the sex industry, because people who work in the sex industry make them uncomfortable, because, you know, they think that women who work in the sex industry are, you know, totally wanton sluts, and, you know, and that kind of sexuality and living by one's wits or whatever are really terrifying to lots of people, and so they then put that on that individual and say that they're afraid of that person in particular, which is kind of crazy if you start to break it down a little bit.
You know, the reactions that, you're right, and it has to do, so much of it has to do just, you know, with being female, with being a sex worker, or even just, you know, anyone that somehow gets deemed as, you know, quote unquote a whore. And,
yeah.
You know, literally as we are talking, this came through to XVN, that there is a controversy. There's a media controversy that doesn't involve a sex worker. It involves a friend of mine, a flight attendant who was fired by Delta because of her blog. Her name is Queen of Sky.
Yeah, and I'm familiar with her.
She did a talk show. Essentially, you know, she did what so many of us have done and went into a talk show. You know, she did a call-in talk show on some, you know, probably the 57th rated station in a 58 station market in L.A. that, you know, appeals to an audience that you know, Vince McMahon turns away because the IQ is too low. And making a long story short, you know, they ambushed her. It was used as an ambush. They called her an immature, self-serving whore and a bitch on the air. Then chastised her for using, you know, a cuss word back, and she responded on her blog, and they did another show about her, and just absolutely went off. And you know, it's really disgusting how the media just, you know, they'll exploit whatever, and God forbid if you're considered a whore.
Right.
You know,
or
at any level.
A whore that talks back.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the thing, one of the things to me that's always been striking about Queen of Sky's whole case is that, you know, she was fired from Delta for essentially being sexual somehow, and, you know, posing in her outfit, in her uniform, in one of their airplanes. And the thing that's always struck me about that is that the whole history of flight attendants has been very much married to female sexuality and very much about this, you know, sexy uniformed attendant who is there to, like, be nice and help you and, you know, all that stuff. And it's a very sexualized service role, but yet when, you know, an employee in that industry kind of grabs that for herself and has fun with it, then it's immediately chastised. And you know, that's something that we see all across our culture with women being sexual, that it's okay for a woman to be sexualized by other people and by her position in life or whatever, but if you kind of take that and own that for yourself and play with it and have fun with it, or God forbid, make money off of it, it suddenly becomes something that's really horrendous. And I think for a lot of women, you know, and for Queen of Sky, people who get caught up in that and, you know, have consequences for it, it's really rough, because in some ways it's like I was just doing what was expected of me as a woman in this culture. and now being punished for it, like, that doesn't make sense. And so that's one of the sort of ugly and weird double standards of our culture.
You know, one of the great ironies that I found of that was that, you know, having been a flight attendant myself, I mean, my first flight attendant job, we wore go-go boots, a mini skirt, you know, and, you know, this from the same airline that is now kicking people off planes because their shirts are too,
right,
you know, too low cut, you know, and one of the issues that Ellen, Queen of Sky, brought up that made a very good point was that, you know, Delta unveiled these new uniforms and, you know, to wear the red Delta dress, I mean, you've got to be 105 pounds mm-hmm. and, you know, there's really no way that I can see you can wear a bra with it. And, you know, and essentially this talk show was chastising her based upon the same type of thing, you know, that they were, their basis was, you know, you wrote this, you did a blog and essentially became, you know, famous, blah, 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 and, you know, they alleged that, you know, she made money off of her book and all this garbage, and, you know, with the essence, yeah, essentially the essence of calling her a prostitute, that's really what it throws down to,
right.
you know, that she, you know, all she did was take control of her own sexuality, and I didn't even really find the pictures on her blog to be particularly, you know, I mean, I've taken pictures like that myself. I mean, it's something that flight attendants do all the time. You know,
yeah.
you fool around on a plane, and you know you're stuck in some outstation like, you know, Flint, Michigan, or something. You know, there's not much to do, so you start to play around, and
right.
You know, and it goes back to your point about, you know, if a woman takes control of her own sexuality, you know, that's just terrible. I mean, it's okay to exploit. It's okay to exploit. It's okay to dress us up, you know, however they want to. But God forbid if we do it ourselves. And,
right.
I realize I kind of went off on a tangent.
That's okay. I mean, it's definitely, it's relevant, so.
You know, I literally, as we were talking, caught the email from Ellen, you know, and what's sad is that, you know, I took it upon myself to, you know, have people write to the station and say, you know, it's not cool to call someone a bitch and an immature, self-serving whore and to blindside somebody like that. And unfortunately, so much of it turned into, you know, I essentially put it out to anybody that I felt worked on women's rights issues. And there was a lot of positive response. There was also a lot of negative, well, you know, you're pro-porn, you're pro-prostitution, and you're just trying to recruit her into porn. And it's just like,
I mean, and that's crazy. Like the whole like pro anti thing. I mean, I think this is starting to get more complicated, and the gray areas are being revealed in more ways. But one of my struggles that I've had over the past couple of years with dealing with, you know, pro and anti arguments is how limiting that conversation is, and how I mean, you know, I wasn't at William & Mary yesterday, but I hope to hear more reports about it. But, I do think that if people would stop being crazy about it, you know, there are some commonalities that people who are sex worker rights advocates have with radical feminists, or should have, that's basically like, we're all concerned about the welfare of women and the ability of women and men to make their own choices about what happens to their bodies and how they make their living. And that's a basic thing that I think most people should be able to agree with if they're not crazy. But then, you know, of course, it quickly erodes into the whole pro and anti thing. And, you know, and one of the things that sometimes I get asked in interviews that is always a really frustrating thing to grapple with is, you know, when I talk about having been a sex worker and having chosen to work in the sex industry, one of the questions that a lot of mainstream media people always ask is, oh, so you must feel empowered by working in the sex industry. And the word empowerment really bugs me. And because I think that's an overly simplistic way of talking about this experience, and that, of course, you know, if I'm empowered, then that means that other people are disempowered. You know, just I think it's a very frustrating and very simplistic way of looking at the whole relationship that people have to the sex industry.
Well, you know, and I find that when you talk about empowering sex workers, that immediately gets flipped around to the sex work. You're saying sex work is empowering for everyone.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and you're like, that's not what I said.
Yeah. I don't know any sex worker who would say that.
You know, I mean, and it's odd that it comes up, you know, so much with sex workers. I mean, there are so many other jobs that, you know, does someone say to, you know, the car salesman, do you feel empowered by being a car salesman?
Right. And then, you know, and then the other thing is, like, despite the fact that when you're talking about sex work, you're talking about money. It's not just about the sex. It's about the money. You know, when, you know, if your response to the question about being empowered, you say, I feel empowered by making money, then you get treated, if it's possible, you get treated like a double whore, because it's like it's one thing to be a whore because you like sex and, you know, the money is a sort of like secondhand benefit to that. But it's another thing to be a whore because you like money. And you know, that level, like, I always find that, you know, the way to shock anyone who's interviewing you about, you know, why you became a sex worker or whatever is to say, for the money. And the look she gets is like, what the fuck? Why does anyone do any job? Seriously.
Exactly. I mean, you know, as I was driving yesterday, I saw this guy putting up a purple camel on top of a car dealership. You know, one of these big, huge blow-up ones for some promotion they're doing. And you know, two thoughts came to mind. And only car dealerships seem to do that. You know, you never see a purple camel at a dentist's office. You know, which I don't know why purple, you know, huge inflatable purple camels only appeal to cars. I mean, I personally would pick a dentist that had a huge inflatable purple camel in the spotlight. But secondly, I mean, if you get up on the ladder, you know, I mean, here it is pouring rain. You know, it's driving rain in Raleigh, North Carolina yesterday, and a thunderstorm, and there's this guy, you know, standing on the roof in a thunderstorm with a huge purple camel, you know, and who would say to him, you know, sir, could you come down the ladder for a moment, please? I just want to ask you, why are you standing in a thunderstorm blowing up a purple camel? Standing on, you know, on the tallest building in the surrounding area. You're there for the money? Really? You know, so it's such a ridiculous double standard. And you're right, it's almost like being a double whore. I hadn't thought of it, you know, but God forbid, not only do you like the sex, but you like the money.
Right. Or you like the money more than the sex. I mean, that's
the money more,
you know,
than
that's
the
one
sex.
Of the things that seems to undermine a lot of stuff that, you know, when, and you know, this comes through in a lot of interviews that I've done with mainstream media. Obviously, the mainstream media portrays sex workers in this very salacious way. And even when the mainstream media is covering, you know, sex workers who are thoroughly exploited and there's no argument about whether or not, you know, the sex workers would rather be doing this or something else. You know, when it really appears that these sex workers are not happy doing what they're doing, or they've been coerced into it, there's still this like disgusting way that the media approaches it that's very exoticized and very sexualized and very sexy. And, you know, to make coerced labor sexy is a really horrendous thing. But you see the mainstream media do it all the time, while at the same time accusing us, people who work in the industry, of exploiting women, etc. And but that's the very thing that the media is doing. And to me, that's one of the things that is so disturbing and so frustrating about the mainstream media's approach to the sex industry. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that people are not educated to discuss sexuality in non-sexualized contexts. And although, you know, people work in the sex industry do this all the time, and it's easy for us to talk about, you know, using condoms or, like, you know, our favorite dildo materials or whatever in a very, like, measured conversational kind of way, we have to remember that for the vast majority of people, it's really impossible to talk about a dildo without laughing about it and without making that naughty and making that dirty and making that sexualized some way. So until our culture develops a way of speaking about sex that isn't sexy, it's really hard to divorce media representations of people who work in the industry in a straightforward way that's not also salacious.
This is XBN, the Swap East Broadcast Network. I'm Jill Brenneman. My guest, Audacia Ray. We have 3 minutes left, according to my audio robot producer that talks in my ear, courtesy of Blog Talk Radio. What points haven't we covered that you would like to get in?
In 3 minutes or less?
In 3 minutes or less.
Oh, my God. I don't know. I mean, I think it's important for people in the sex industry and people outside the sex industry to talk to each other about these issues and to both produce and consume media around these issues. And, you know, if you're a sex worker and you don't want to create your own media, you know, a lot of mainstream media websites now have open comments on articles, write letters to the editor, bitch at people when you see things that are wrong, or, you know, and when you recognize a sex worker in the media, send them words of encouragement and support. And it's something that, you know, everybody needs to have more conversations about this stuff. And I think that's, for me, that's my activism pitch on the very basic level, that I think before all sorts of political and economic activism can happen, people need to get used to talking about what we do and talking to each other about what we do, and accepting the charge of talking to mainstream media or rejecting it. And I think the communication stuff is really, really key to having any kind of sex worker rights movement that's sustainable.
And one more time, if you can give out the URLs and contact information.
Sure thing. My personal website is wakingvixen.com. The best way to get in touch with me is to email me at Dacia, that's D-A-C-I-A, at wakingvixen.com. I'm the editor of nakedcity.com, which is a blog for the Village Voice, and I am one of the board members of Sex Work Awareness. Our first public education project is sexwork101.com.
You're doing wonderful work, and I am so appreciative of having you on the show. You know, I always find near the end of the show that I always wish we had more time, and you know, I certainly welcome you to come back, and, you know, anytime.
I'll come back anytime, for sure.
Yeah. You know, I certainly look forward to hearing more from you, and I enjoy your blog post myself, so I would definitely encourage others to seek you out. My guest has been Audacia Ray. My name is Jill Brenneman. This is XBN, the Swap East Broadcast Network. Swap East Broadcast Network is xxbn.net, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. service of Swapeast Media, swopeest.org. Our next scheduled show, tentatively, will be a recap of the William & Mary events. I'm Joe Burnham, and this is XBN.
Blog Talk Radio. Thank you.